on 2FM.
Now, if it's not a contradiction to say, but the guy sitting across from me is best known for being anonymous. That is, he was the anonymous racing driver, the Stig, on Top Gear for many years. Quite apart from Top Gear, he's a professional racing driver, also a stunt double for James Bond, most recently in Quantum of Solace. He's no stranger to high-speed car chases, but he's here today because he's written a book called How to Drive, and this is not a book necessarily for people who are stunt drivers or fast people. It's for you and me, Joe Bloggs, Joe Ordinary, or Mary Ordinary now. Welcome to the programme, Ben. Ben, what makes a guy who races at a million miles an hour, what makes you think you have the right to tell me how to drive?
It's a great point. I suppose, most of my expertise is at the extreme end of driving. So, skidding cars around on Top Gear and at high speed on the racetrack. So I'm an expert in controlling speed, but there's a whole world of difference between that and driving on the road. So to write this book, I've brought that expertise to bear, because it is relevant. When we do a driving test, you get through really with the bare minimum of training.
What you say in the book is this, which is quite bizarre. Like, we all do the thing of, learning off the bits about what road signs means and all that, which is the kind of practical exam, if you like. You go around your supermarket on a Saturday afternoon some afternoon when it's shut, and your father brings you around or something, and you do maybe less than, and this is a quotable statistic, I think, less than 18 hours or something, yeah, like that. It's what normally do. Whereas you then say, if you want to run the coffee machine in a bloody, Starbucks or something, it'll take you 24 hours minimum before you get the keys to that. Yep. And yet you get the keys to this crazy, stupid, idiotic, mad thing that can kill people in an instant, not just you.
That's it.
Right, that's it in a nutshell. So basically, it's for everybody to realise that when they're on the road and they've left that learner thing go, they really aren't necessarily that good at what they do, because you're never that good. You can never let the controls go.
Well, I spent 3 years analysing all this. I had a fantastic time watching my eyes bleed as I went through all the government stats and road stats and police stats and medical statistics of who, what, why, where and how accidents happen on the road. And having analysed it, you really see a clear picture that in the first 2 years you learn by accident, and I mean that literally, either by crashing into stuff or by near misses and frights. So what do you learn in that 2 years? You learn by experience, and it's experience you could gain in other ways, and that's what I've tried to set out. So I'll take you through every type of road environment, every type of weather condition, all the stuff you don't learn in a test, how to overtake, handle a motorway, drive in the ice and the snow, and also by my mistakes, which are plentiful, and quite severe. So, some people need a bit more confidence, a bit of encouraging, so I'm there for that. But also, in the case of me, I had to have my confidence tempered a bit.
Right.
Because I was way too cocky.
Okay, well, I mean, like, the book is laid out in such a way that it's really, like, accessible to everybody, but some of the statistics that you have in there are pretty scary stuff. You say that car crashes kill 50% more people, say, than malaria. The World Health Organization said it's going to be 52% more by the year 2030, more people die on the roads, etc. Yeah. And also, like, for instance, you show, as you say, to control a skid or drive on the motorway or tackle a corner or drive at night or overtake. I want to get to overtake a little bit later on. But the government and the road safety people, etc., you say it one stage that they wrap us in cotton wool and then try to pull that wool over our eyes. Are we blind to the realities of it all?
I think so, because the driving test itself, in our islands, it was certainly in the UK, it was invented in 1935-ish for the police by a racing driver, and the skills you learn, even how to hold the steering wheel and how to shuffle it through your hands, that's very outdated. It's an old model. It needs a refresh, and really the power of the human brain is totally underutilised on the road, and really with a small effort we can all do a lot better. And I think I'd much rather see that, and people sort of make better use of their car, enjoy their driving more, than to have everything just be banned, because that's where the government's going. And you've got stretches of dual carriageway here that are 50k limit on them, yet on the open road, really that's where it's more dangerous, and the limit is much higher. And I'm not saying clamp down speeds and put cameras everywhere. That is just not the way to do it. That just means you're panicking the whole time, looking at cameras, looking for variable speed limits and average speed limits and all this nonsense.
Yeah, true.
When actually you should be paying attention to what you're doing, and that's all I'm pushing for, really, is people just to take a bit more care and attention in how they approach their skills.
Funny you should say that. On the road from Wicklow back up to Dublin, there's a little piece of about 4 miles long or 4 kilometres long that suddenly goes from blah to blah. Like, I mean, you're supposed to go decelerate to the power of a million, and then you can go back up, and it's like, doesn't seem to be any reason or any rhyme, and you're constantly looking out for things you shouldn't have to be. But the thing about speeding, it's really bad. Speeding is very important, that 14 or 18% or something of accidents are caused because of speeding, as you say in the book. But bad driving is what it's all about.
Exactly. I mean, inappropriate speed is what does a lot of harm, but mostly it's from not paying attention. And it's amazing when you look at it, when you really break it down, nearly all accidents occur because of or around junctions.
Yeah.
And when you put it in context, it's from people pulling out, People not indicating when they pull off roads and you're overtaking them and you're alongside when it happens. I found it, at times, it's funny because you start to stereotype what situations you recognise all the time on the road. But that's what it's about. It's recognising those patterns. And it's actually quite easy to avoid them.
Okay, well, this is what the book is all about. It's how to drive. So let's just get back to you then and what you're all about. How did you get into racing cars in the first place?
Well, I grew up on a farm, driving all manner of stuff, but quite late got into racing. I think it was my parents trying to get rid of me and get me off the tractors. So age 19, went out, got my race licence and off I went, and pursued the single-seater path, trying to get to Formula 1, which is a tough game, and I won at the Formula 3 level before switching across to Le Mans sports cars, which is what I still do. So I race Le Mans 24 hours. Day and night, rain and shine, it's just fantastic. So we've got a whole load of Formula 1 drivers in there now, from Mark Webber. I think Jenson Button might be joining the fray next year as well. I love it there. That's my real passion, is competing.
Okay, and then just tell us about the Stig then, which is the big one in turn. Like, it's bizarre. That's why people know you for... Oh, no, wait, they don't. It's just so weird. So how did the Stig role come about for you?
Well, the Black Stig was my predecessor.
Yeah.
And he wasn't around for very long, and they killed his character off. So there was an opening, and it was around the time I'd gotten in touch with the show. I thought it looked amazing, so I sent my CV in and was met by the producer of the show. Did some fast times that were better than the previous Stig, so they fired him off the carrier, aircraft carrier, and the White Stig was born. And I stayed there for 8 years, so it was amazing. And by the end, it was one of the most Googled questions on the planet was, who is the Stig?
Yeah.
It was crazy, and it was in the top 10 searches, just in front of what is the meaning of life. But it wasn't quite up there with am I pregnant? So I never made it to the one spot, but I felt important.
Yeah, that's pretty important, all right. But like, you were to set lap times on the programme, test drive cars and all the rest, and prepare celebrities for the show. Obviously, like, we know of some of the biggest names. You were there, from Usain Bolt to Ron Wood to obviously Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman. Was it fun?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah. Racing.
Were you looking after them all day long, like 2 days, 3 days even?
No, not even that long. I mean, I had a short space of time. It was great meeting those sportsmen, especially as well as all those people there. The Usains of this one, Usain Bolt, was extremely quick given his weight, because that was a very small car, the reasonably priced car, very light, which meant that if you were heavy, it had quite a big effect on the car's performance. They were great, but also I really enjoyed teaching different people, seeing everybody. No two people learn the same way, and certainly when I was writing the book, I was always thinking about the people I met over time and how people need. Some people need encouraging, some people need holding back, and just the simple things, silly simple things like. First thing I'd do is show them the steering position and bring them closer to the pedals, because a lot of people drive around, their legs are too straight, and when they have to press the brake pedal hard to avoid an accident, they can't, because their legs are too straight. They haven't got the leverage on the pedal. Silly and simple.
And when you were there on the set, like, for so many years, did you have to arrive with this sort of Star Wars helmet that I have here in front of me on your head? Did you have to eat by yourself? Did you have to stay away from everybody? Because the anonymity was the thing.
Yes, I kept the helmet on the whole time, so no one ever saw me. I turned up to work with no identity, because actually we had journalists rifling through our stuff, and it was a great game, and I wanted to keep that game going as long as possible, because I loved the job, and ultimately, once they knew your identity, the job was over. So I always knew it would come to an end. It was one of those things you knew from the beginning, but what a ride. I mean, it lasted 8 years, which was great.
And when it was going to come to an end, when the whole thing was going to happen like that, what does that actually mean in terms of the way you got on or didn't get on with the people?
Well, it was a sad thing, but it was like I said, I could see it coming. So at that point that it had reached fever pitch, it was the BBC, funnily enough, that leaked it to the BBC make Top Gear to the Radio Times there. So that was quite unhelpful, because after that, all the papers ran that story, and we got Michael Schumacher in to throw some smoke over the situation. But it wasn't enough in the end.
Okay, so then what happens after all that? Like, when you decide to leave, you decide to write a book, and you decide to write, in other words, an autobiography, if you like, and tell the story. There was a lot of bad vibes, wasn't there?
There was. It was hard to understand. Obviously, they wanted to try and maintain the secret, but by the time it was front page news, it was really, the game was up.
Yeah.
So I handed my notice in to my boss, had my book. I wrote that and wanted to sort of tell my side of the story, because I knew there'd be a lot of PR attention. And then we had this strange situation of going through the High Court, where they were trying to gag me for the rest of my days, and I didn't feel that was fair. So I fought it. The judge agreed. He was laughing as he read the newspaper with my face on the front of it, saying, "This is not a secret, guys, let him go."
Right, OK, very good. And when you say Michael Schumacher, he was unveiled as the Stig at one stage, that was just all part of it. Like, I mean, you were the butt of a lot of jokes with these guys. Is that part of the whole thing as well? Were you OK with that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you learn, actually, especially with the Top Gear lot, the banter is pretty ripe, and everybody dishes it out, and we were never shy of dishing it out to the presenters as well. We had a good laugh with them. So I think the Stig's one of those great characters. You can twist it in many ways, and from Where's Wally to Stig Soap on Rope, which still gives me a lot of nightmares. I wake up screaming, thinking of my brother Stig's and the abuses they were put to. You know, and it's a great laugh, and I had a lot of fun trooping around London in character and doing those mad races where you go around the place, and had nothing to do with driving whatsoever. It was all about this persona.
And what about the star in the reasonably priced car then, of the people? I didn't ask you there, I just mentioned a few. Was there anybody that really impressed you, and for what reason would they have? I mean, like, I didn't see the James Blunt one, but people said that was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, he was funny. I mean, I love the guys that were cool and calm enough that they could have a joke and a gag while they're going around. We had one of the most memorable was a guy came in. His goal was to beat the slowest time we had, which didn't sound that interesting, but he was completely blind. So that, you know, it was a massive thing for me to try and teach somebody to drive the lap without being able to see where they're going. So we had to start from scratch, really, with how I taught him. He beat five people. It was absolutely amazing. It was by far the coolest thing I did on the show. And so Billy Baxter, he beat five people that could see on that lap. And I never touched the wheel once. He did everything himself. It was remarkable.
Well, the coolest thing he did big screen-wise, either with standing in for Nicolas Cage in National Treasure 2, or, I would imagine, obviously, Quantum of Solace. When you think of Quantum of Solace in the opening scene and the way it is, mother jeepers, there's stuff going on there in cars that should have you sitting onto your cinema seat like this.
Yeah.
Was that you doing that?
It was. So we had a stunt team there that's world-renowned, the Bond stunts. There's no CGI on a Bond film, so everything you see is real. Working on the Quantum of Solace, that was my first Bond, and I went on to Skyfall and got to drive the old DB5 with the ejector seat.
I was just going to say, like, do you have a reverence for the DB5 as they did in the movie? When he opens the garage and shows it to her, like, there's a lot of Bond people from 40 years ago go, oh my God, there it is.
Oh, it was amazing. That night, we're in London to open the garage door, and Sam Mendes, the director, was already in there with Daniel Craig, and they were standing at the back like two schoolboys talking and trying to look like they were interested in what each other was saying, but really they were staring at the car, because it's such a special thing to drive, and it is beautiful. You sit in there, it's got these great big leather sofa seats, very soft suspension, like Blancmange. The brakes don't work too well. It's got a great big steering wheel from a boat.
Do you know how important it was to have one of those little things in your hand when you were a kid? I'm sure you didn't, but certainly in my day, it was just the biggest thing.
Yeah.
It was just so cool. And I presume it didn't have an ejector seat or anything like that.
I did not dare press the button. So I never found out really if it worked, but it's just such an iconic car, and in its day, 120 miles an hour, I think, is what it could do, and that was extremely quick. It was a proper sports car back then.
All right, just go back to Quantum of Solace. Sorry, I interrupted you there at the beginning of that. So, like, is that, like, there's no CGI? That's you doing what I saw there doing.
Yeah, high speed. I remember.
Did you sign a will beforehand?
I did, actually. You had to take your heart was in your mouth, because they were doing very high speed, weaving in and out of traffic, and at one point, I remember doing over 130 mile an hour through a tunnel with the lights off, and it was full of smoke to try and make it look more arty. And there were these kinks in through the tunnel, and you had to count time between each corner, because they were blind, and that was what we were doing. And learning it by rote from memory, the timing between these kinks, because I couldn't see them. That was pretty special, and to get paid to do that, it's just fantastic for me. That's I love doing it.
And by the way, to relate that to the current book that you have now, I mean, like, you've done one of the most dangerous overtaking manoeuvres in that sequence that you talked about there. Have you got tips for regular folks on how to overtake safely?
I think the thing with every part of driving is we all need to look further ahead and give yourself more time. And with overtaking, it's a similar pattern to a lot of problems you see on the road where people follow too closely, and it's no different with overtaking other cars. People get right up the gearbox or the tailpipe of the car in front, have a look, and then floor it from effectively a stationary position, because you're matching the speed of the car in front. Whereas if you hang back, you can see much more, you can see much further ahead, and you can roll into the move, so you carry speed into the overtake, and that's much safer.
All right, the seeing much further ahead, you do have a thing in the book there where you go right back to the history of why some, like, we all drive on the left-hand side, America, say, drives the right-hand side. You say that we have it right and the rest of them have it wrong.
Yeah, Napoleon started it off.
Wow,
because
you're really going back.
He was left-handed, so he made his army march on the right, and that's why they ended up driving on the right. Hitler carried that on because he wasn't the brightest. And the Americans, sort of two fingers up to the Brits, they drove on the right as well, and their cars were mass-produced, and so many countries that imported those cars had to switch their side over to the right to match the American imports. So we are correct on the left side. If you don't believe me, check out the aircraft carriers.
Are the statistics? I mean, the statistics will prove that the left has lower collisions than the right, doesn't it?
It pretty much does. And
Sorry. What about one of the airplanes there you're saying?
Yeah, aircraft carriers. It's a great one. A friend of mine's in the Navy, and he mentioned this when we were debating it. And every aircraft carrier in the world, from Chinese, Russian, American, British, the control tower is on the right-hand side of the ship, and the airplanes always approach from the left-hand side because they want their dominant eye on the only thing they're going to hit for 20 miles, which is that contour.
So two-thirds of the world is driving on the wrong side of the road.
It is.
Not the left or the right, the wrong side.
Yeah.
The other one, the third one. I love it. Okay. You do say at one stage, by the way, I'll quote you this, you'll be so sexy through the corners that your passengers will need a cold shower after every journey. Is that what you can recommend? Have you met people and said, I'm just going to have a cold shower?
Every time I drop a passenger off, they rush off. They pour ice down their pants and they jump in the shower.
Right, okay, I walked into that. All right, yeah, okay, fair enough. This is for people who are equally ready to drive a Fiat or a Ferrari, right?
Yes.
That's really what it is. Like, it's not your fast stuff necessarily, Le Mans or whatever.
Balancing a car, it doesn't matter if it's front-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, 4x4. Balancing a car is all about how the tyres work. And so that's why you treat it in a certain way. So you aim to brake in a straight line, you release the brakes when you start steering, and then as you open the steering, that's when you start accelerating. But people forget that order because they were never taught it. So it works in any car. And I think this book hopefully works for any age. I've tried to make it as funny as I can. I've got loads of stories in there. No one wants to read Death by the Highway Code. It's just so boring. So this is not revision for your driving test. It's really everything that's not contained in the test.
And also the philosophy of speed, as you mentioned, and the economy of motion. You're talking about greater fuel efficiency, control and safety and all the rest of it too, which a lot of people don't think about. I mean, vision is the biggest thing by the sound of it, just looking.
It is, totally. Everyone always thinks that racing drivers try and drive through corners as quickly as possible, and you'd be surprised to know that it's not about that, and it's about slowing the car in the right way, controlling it, and getting out of the corner alive, effectively, and in a controlled way. So that works on the racetrack, and the same system of driving works on the road, and it can make you a lot safer. And even just by being smooth, you save 20% on your fuel bill, as you say.
Yeah.
And it makes you look ahead. And if you can look ahead, then you won't crash because you see it coming from a long way away.
Okay, the book is all about telling people how to drive better. Do you suffer yourself, by the way, from road rage when you're out and about?
I get really angry about different things. I get really frustrated with the government, actually. Just the changing speed limits when you're going from a 30 to a 50 to a 60 to a,
back
to a
20. Yeah, that's what I was talking about earlier. Crazy.
It's just, it's way too much. It's absolute overload for the driver. There are way too many road signs, and it's overload. The only thing that matters in an urban area is that you've got your eyes up and you're looking for pedestrians, you're not going to hit them. Then it's open road, it's concentrating on what you're doing because you don't want to run into the ditch and hurt yourself. And motorways, really, it's great because it's just uncluttered, and that's straightforward, but we're just being slapped with more and more speed restrictions in the places you don't need it, and far too many signs in places where your eyeballs are, you know, information overload. So
we're talking here about Ben Collins in terms of the Stig and that. Of the last few years, what's it like not being the Stig? Is it fine? Do you like the life now that you can say, listen, it's me now, I can take the helmet off?
It is. It's a breath of fresh air. Actually, it's a strange thing that when I knew it was coming to an end, it was the weirdest sensation. It was a moment I had dreaded for years, and there was enormous weight lifted off my shoulders that I never knew existed.
Yeah.
Because I loved the job, but there was always this, you know, you never want it to end. But subsequently, you know, I'm still working in TV. I'm working on these amazing car chases in movies.
Yeah.
And I'm racing at Le Mans. I love what I do. So, you know, nothing's really changed. I still get to wear a helmet, but it's just not a white one. So,
right. But a lot of people are saying the Top Gear, no matter how much it hits the headlines lately, and my God, some of the stuff that's in the headlines, not just Argentina, but even before that too, with the slopes and all these kind of mentions, a lot of people are saying that the Top Gear Formula has got a bit tired. Do you think it has?
I wouldn't disagree with it. It's very hard to keep one format going. You know, the boys, I think they're very entertaining. They're brilliant, I think, when they're explaining a scenario or an environment. The three of them bantering to each other, you know, for me, that's sort of, it's a strain, I think, for a while, and that's when you end up doing these controversial...
blokes locker room stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of a bit...
It just means you end up courting controversy just for the sake of it, and I don't think they need to. It just needs to go, you know, back to basics in a way and start getting stuck into the reviews and do what they do best. And they when they're doing that, they're doing it very well.
By the way, Ben, women and older people unfairly get a lot of flack, or is it unfairly, for being bad drivers. Who, in your experience, are actually the bad drivers?
All of us.
Right.
We all, you know, we're all suffering the same things on the road. I don't think you can't sort of pigeonhole one group of people. It's interesting. The old blame the young, and the young can actually blame the old. And it's a classic. It's one of them. Is the like I say, the overtaking. Older people, you know, tend to slow down and not indicate when they, you know, pull off to a junction, and it's the young ones that drive straight into the side of them because they're overtaking them. So they're both at fault. I think we can all improve. So no, I don't think there's any one group that's particularly bad.
And by the way, pre Top Gear for you, like you were like doing all sorts of racing. I think you were in the SAS at some stage. You did a bit of hand to hand combat, but I think you were basically teaching them all how to drive or something along those lines.
I did some driver training stuff.
But you were doing something in America, the NASCAR thing. And that, was there once a $10 million deal on the table, or was that a myth?
Well, I wish there was. If there was, they should have told me.
Right.
I was very close to, I mean, I'm racing Le Mans, which is great. I'd love to race NASCAR, still would. I won the European Championship, tested with Red Bull, and that went really well. But it's a very tough nut to crack, because unless you're from the States and you're American, you're living there, it's very tough, you know. But I'm still working on that quietly.
The other guys on Top Gear all became millionaires in that, and like, did you? There was spin-offs and things. Were you invited into those spin-offs? Were you allowed to create any part of those spin-offs? Were you allowed to be at discussions about things like that?
Or no, I had to spin off on my own.
All right.
So that was fine. It really didn't bother me. The only thing was that once I was there for a while. The longer I was there, it started to become ever so commercial. Everything was becoming much more heavy in that sense. And that's when really I started coming under fire for, you know, the suggestion that they have multiple STIGs. And I really wasn't up for that. I thought, well, yeah. I've been here a long time, so I've been loyal to the programme and I'd expect the same back. That's why I left, really.
All right, well, listen, look, thanks a million, Ben. How to Drive is the simple title of it. It's by Ben Collins, published by Macmillan. It's out now, and it is, as I say, for all the family, male, female, not just old or young, but everybody, the perfect Christmas present, isn't
it? Enjoy the ride.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ben. Thanks. Life.